To continue with this chapter, the last three paragraphs, I think, the philosophy of rebirth. In our last class, we had done para 27, and we had discussed a major, not a major, at least a very popular notion regarding taking the human body, the human being can go back to the animal stage and take a rebirth there. But then we have seen Sri Aurobindo telling us it's not quite possible, except of course there are exceptional cases where the human being, after having taken such a big leap, human soul actually, after having taken a decisive leap from the animal to the human, it doesn't go back. Except of course when there is this question of the animal, a loose holding of an animal. If there is within the human being the attachment, the desire, etc., then it may take temporarily an animal form, or more it's the vital sheath. Then after having satiated there, it comes back immediately to the human birth. It doesn't continue in the animal. Well, I don't discuss that because we have done quite at length this paragraph. I'll take up para 28 today. Because if you remember, we had two questions to answer. First question was in para 27, where it says, then the further question arises whether humanity once attained, this succession of rebirths still continues, and if so, how, by what series or by what alternations? And first, we have to ask whether the soul, having once arrived at humanity, can go back to the animal life and body. So that was the first question, and the second one is being taken up in para 28, where it starts off saying, but why a succession of human births and not one alone? For the same reason that has made the human birth itself a culminating point of the past succession, the previous upward series, it must be so by the very necessity of the spiritual evolution. For the soul has not finished what it has to do by merely developing into humanity. It has still to develop that humanity into higher possibilities. Obviously, the soul that lodges in a Caribbee or an untaught primitive or an Apache of Paris or an American gangster has not yet exhausted the necessity of human birth, has not developed at all its possibilities, or the whole meaning of humanity, has not worked out all the sense of Satchidananda in the universal man. Neither has the soul lodged in a vitalistic European occupied with dynamic production and vital pleasure, or in an Asiatic peasant engrossed in the ignorant round of the domestic and economic life. So you can see Sri Aurobindo giving us very simple examples to tell us how the soul, once having come to the human level, has to take many births because it has still not attained to that level where it can kind of, you know, cease to take rebirths. He has given us a little cross-section of American gangsters or the Apache of the Paris or the European vitalistic man, or even in the simple peasant, you know, going about his farming and a daily routine. This itself throws some light that there is, you know, there are all kinds of levels of human experience, but they are, you know, all these souls are not yet come to the spiritual level of life. So until one arrives to a determined and a dedicated spiritual life, I mean, not only turning, please remember, it's not just a question of turning to spiritual life, but becoming a spiritual man, as he has referred to, coming to the level of a spiritual evolution. Rebirth is compulsory, because it has to pass through so many births, having so many different experiences, before it can reach the spiritual status. You see, while being a peasant, of course, the mother did tell us once when we were in Auroville, the poorest of the peasants in India is closer to God in his heart than the intellects and the scholars of Europe. So that there is a value of closeness to the divine. So it could be a peasant or an intellect or somebody or the other. But if there is an arrogance in the mind, then of course you do not go close to the divine. So simplicity of the mind, a humility of the mind is perhaps very necessary to be close to the divine. So she says the peasant is close in the heart to God. So you see, the heart is always closer to the divine than the mind, because the intellect gets arrogant. I think there was a little quotation in Saka this morning. I was saying that God speaks to man through his heart when his mind does not understand him, something like that. So you see, always the mind is away because it has so many doubts and arguments and debates that it even questions the existence of God. But whereas the heart in its simplicity has no questions, it's a beautiful dedication. And again, I remember Sri Ramakrishna's famous saying that the bumblebee, the honeybee, keeps humming on the flower, goes around different flowers, it makes a buzzing noise. But when it sits to sip the nectar, then it is quiet. It doesn't make any noise. So that's exactly what the nature of the mind and the heart. As long as you are in the mind, you have all the noise of your questions and doubts and debates. Why and why not? But once you really start experiencing him in the heart level, once you start loving him, the mind has no more any question. That is, should not. So that's the, otherwise it only means you are not sipped the honey, you are still going about doing the mental business. So he says here, all these simple people of Asia or the vitalistic people of Europe or the American gangsters, looking at them you'll surely think that God has much more things to do to the human life than that. But he goes to the other extreme to say, we may reasonably doubt whether even a Plato or a Shankara mark the crown and therefore the end of the outflowering of the spirit in man. Because that should not be another conclusion. Okay, if the peasant is not good, if a Shankaracharya or say any of these great vibhutis, if Plato or even Einstein or a Michelangelo or your great Ashokas, are they the end of the spiritual personality? He would say no. He says, we are apt to suppose that these may be the limit, because these and others like them seem to us the highest point which the mind and soul of man can reach. But that may be the illusion of our present possibility. There may be a higher or at least a larger possibility which the divine intends yet to realize in man. And if so, it is the steps built by these highest souls which were needed to compose the way up to it and to open the gates. You can see all these great vibhutis, great minds, great intellects, these are all only kind of, milestones on the road. But that's not the highest. Even for humanity, maybe Shankaracharya or the Plato or King Ashoka turned to be a Buddhist, maybe great and high souls. But he said these are only landmarks, milestones. because that is only leading us toward the spiritual man and then the beyond. But that's not the end. So he says it is a kind of an illusion, because the human mind can't think of anyone beyond Shankara or a beyond Plato or a beyond Socrates. But he says, for the present, that may be your limit, but in the next sentence he would tell us, at any rate, this present highest point at least must be reached before we can write finis on the recurrence of the human birth for the individual. Man is there to move from the ignorance and from the little life which he is in his mind and body to the knowledge and the large divine life which he can compass by the unfolding of the spirit. At least the opening out of the spirit in him, the knowledge of his real self and the leading of the spiritual life must be attained before he can go definitively and forever otherwhere. You see, that's the sentence I was looking for. The knowledge of his real self and the leading of the spiritual life must be attained before he can go definitely and forever otherwise. So that is why he's telling us that all these vitalistic people or the simpleton from Asia or the great people or even Shankaracharya or a Plato need not be the limits. Shankara has given us the example of the knowledge of the real self, that a man can reach that height. So Shankaracharya, Swami Vivekananda could be those peaks from where you can go elsewhere, otherwhere, beyond, and reach a spot of non-rebirth. But one has to come to that level. So until you have that knowledge of his real self and the leading of the spiritual life. So you can see how in evolution now, in the individual as the collective, why Sri Aurobindo is envisaging the spiritual age as the culmination, if not the culmination, the peak of evolution. Because that's where and when you come to know yourself and the divine directly. Up until then, you can have glimpses, you can have perhaps a little taste of the divinity, a little bhakti to your guru or to the divine, but all that is only a preparation. So you can see, one has to come to the level of almost a Swami Vivekananda or a Shankaracharya before we can hope to really think that I shall not be reborn again. So it's not just a question of people, you know, saying that I will do this vrata, I will do that vrata and see that I'm not reborn. It's not one's wish. It is the soul's own development. So, the peak of evolution, human evolution, is always the spiritual man. That's why we in India have always respected these spiritual people, the rishis, because they are the peak of human evolution itself. Then he says, there may too be beyond this initial culmination a greater flowering of the spirit in the human life, of which we have as yet only the first intimations. The imperfection of man is not the last word of nature, but his perfection too is not the last peak of the spirit. A magnificent conclusion. You see, obviously the imperfection of man is the last word, is not the last word, because there's so much more to do, there's so much more to develop, and so much perfection to come in. So if I say perfection is a Plato or a Socrates or a Swami or a Shankaracharya or a Swami Vivekananda, even that perfection is not the last step of the Lord, of the Divine. Because beyond the perfection of man, the species called man, there is a next species called the Superman. So how can there be a perfection of man? Can it be the peak? There is always a peak beyond. So he says, this possibility becomes a certitude if the present leading principle of the mind as man has developed it, the intellect, is not its highest principle. If mind itself has other powers as yet only imperfectly possessed by the highest types of the human individual, Then a prolongation of the line of evolution and consequently of the ascending line of rebirth to embody them is inevitable. So you see, we may have all the spiritual people. I mean, he has given two names, so I'm repeating them, because it's safe to do that. A Plato or a Shankara. Say, I mean, I do not, I have no idea about Plato's spiritual attainments. But let's say what Trajasaral told about Shankaracharya. He has definitely had this question of the knowledge of his real self, knowledge of the Brahman, realization of Brahman, all that is beyond any doubt and question. And yet, that need not be the highest peak from where rebirth stops, because in the human intellect itself, if mind itself has other powers as yet only imperfectly possessed, that means the mind is not the ultimate peak of evolution, because within the human potentiality there are other levels beyond mind, and that level, what you call the supermind, is there. So it only means that until a human being not only knows the Brahman, please see this difference, he can realize the divine, he can realize the Brahman or his true self. But that is not the pinnacle of human evolution. The pinnacle is when he gets that highest level of the mind itself. In fact, as a concluding sentence, to say, he says, if Superman also is a power of consciousness concealed here in the evolution, the line of rebirth cannot stop even there. It cannot cease in its ascent before the mental has been replaced by the supramental nature and an embodied supramental being becomes the leader of terrestrial existence. You see, this whole para is of one of the most important things that we have got here in this chapter, that when, at what level will rebirth stop or cease or not become redundant? Only when the supramental nature replaces the mind or the mental nature. So even if the mind reaches the supermind, which is its highest potential, there also rebirth does not cease. You see, there may have been people in the ashram who have reached the supermind, the supramental consciousness, but that does not mean that they have stopped the rebirths. It is only when the supramental nature and embodied supramental being become the leader of terrestrial existence. So you see, all these great sadhaks in the ashram or great rishis during the Vedic times or the Upanishadic times or the whatever the time they have been, all of them per se have to take rebirth. It may be higher, great spiritual being, instruments, etc., whatever you may call them. Because rebirth will cease only when the supramental nature and embodied supramental being becomes the leader of terrestrial existence. Say, after 500 years or 1000 years, whatever the time, when the dominant consciousness upon earth is that of the superman or the supramental embodied supramental being, then for those beings rebirth becomes redundant. So you see, every human soul or the psychic being, it may become spiritual, it may have realized the Brahman, it may go beyond, but it has to come back. It has to come back, because the whole cycle and the process of the rebirth of that particular psychic being does not end until it reaches the superman or the supramental nature. Not just a supramental consciousness, please remember that. Because the consciousness, many of them, not many, some of the ashram sadhaks have attained. But they are bound to come back. Because they have not attained the supramental embodied being. That means a physical transformation. The sadhaks have not gotten that kind of a physical transformation. They may have experienced a lot of things. So that's what he says. So this is the conclusion, that if the Superman also is a power of consciousness concealed here in the evolution, the line of rebirth cannot stop even there. Even there means when the supermind is attained. It stops only, it cannot cease in its ascent before the mental has been replaced by the supramental nature. You see, the word is replaced. So up until then, every human psychic being or every psychic being in the human body, each time taking a higher birth, evolving to greater levels of consciousness, has to come back. This then is the rational and philosophical foundation for a belief in rebirth. It is an inevitable logical conclusion. If there exists at the same time an evolutionary principle in the earth nature and a reality of the individual soul born into evolutionary nature, if there is no soul, there can be a mechanical evolution without necessity or significance, and birth is only part of this curious but senseless machinery. We have dealt with this major idea that there are two aspects. One is the principle of evolution on the universal scale, and the second is the principle of rebirth on the individual scale. So they always go in hand in hand. But if there is no evolution, if there is no rebirth, then we could think of a human being just being born once. Like you see, for example, a little flower, a plant that is there on in your garden. For example, this beautiful flower called prayer. It comes with the first rain. It's there for a day, it offers itself to nature, to the divine, and it's gone. That flower is not reborn. It flowers for a day. So similarly, human beings could be there just enjoying flowering for one life, and there ends the matter. That is, if there is no soul, which we have established is not an acceptable notion at all. So if the individual is only a temporary formation beginning and ending with the body, then evolution can be a play of the all-soul or cosmic existence, mounting through a progression of higher and higher species towards its own utmost possibility in this becoming, or to its highest conscious principle. Rebirth does not exist and is not needed as a mechanism of that evolution. Or if the all-existence expresses itself in a persistent but illusory individuality, rebirth becomes a possibility or an illusory fact. But it has no evolutionary necessity and is not a spiritual necessity. It is only a means of accentuating or prolonging the illusion up to its utmost limit, sun limit. Well, this is only a kind of a summary and conclusive paragraph, so just touching upon the idea that we have discussed before, that there could be a possibility that, you know, the rebirth becomes a possibility. You know, you come back, as they have seen in Buddhism, there the rebirth is a possibility and a necessity, but not necessarily is there a spiritual evolution, because there is no soul in Buddhism. So such a possibility is there. It says for those who believe that there is no soul, they have argued that. But we have seen how he refutes even Buddhist argument. And lastly, if there is an individual soul or purusha not dependent on the body but inhabiting and using it for this purpose, then rebirth begins to be possible. But it is not a necessity if there is no evolution of the soul in nature. The presence of the individual soul in an individual body may be a passing phenomenon, a single experience without a past here or a future. Its past and its future may be elsewhere. Well, I remember even this argument, which was the third argument of the mechanical, you know, the third argument of the religious type, that there could be a birth of a soul which is there just for one life. It comes into the human body, it goes away. Then if you remember, Sri Aurobindo had argued From where does it come? Where does it go to? Then is it just a fancy that the whole divine play is there for just one life? A little bit of a burst of a joy or an enjoyment and nothing more. So all those arguments, I think if you recollect, you will see, they have all been discussed at length, so I'm not getting back into that. But if there is an evolution of consciousness in an evolutionary body, and a soul inhabiting the body, a real and conscious individual, then it is evident that it is a progressive experience of that soul in nature which takes the form of this evolution of consciousness. Rebirth is self-evidently a necessary part, the sole possible machinery of an evolution. It is as necessary as birth itself. For without it, birth would be an initial step without a sequel. The starting of a journey without its farther steps and arrival. It is rebirth that gives the birth of an incomplete being in a body its promise of completeness and its spiritual significance. This has been a magnificent paragraph, a brilliant one, because you can see all the four major arguments that we have had previously in this chapter have been beautifully covered. And if you have notes or if you remember, go back to that. So the last line you can see is so very beautifully put. It is as necessary as birth itself. Because without rebirth, there is hardly any meaning to birth. It is incomplete. It has no value. It has no continuity. So it says, it is rebirth that gives to the birth of an incomplete being in a body's promise of completeness. So you see, those religions which think that we come only once in only one life, I really don't know how they really give any meaning to this existence, how they give any value to this present life. Well, these questions will be coming back again in the third chapter, Rebirth and the Other Worlds, third in the sequence, as I told you. But the next chapter will be complete here, the philosophy of rebirth. But as I said, these are the three chapters, the order of the worlds and rebirth and the other worlds and other worlds. These make kind of internal link. But as I told you, it is not possible to take it up in the next few classes that are remaining with us. But what I have decided to do is actually take up from volume 16, SABCL volume 16. His writings, his short essays on rebirth, the problem of rebirth. So, which is in a way giving these ideas that we have had in this philosophy of rebirth and the next chapter, all these are covered beautifully in a simple manner in the problem of rebirth. So, for the remaining classes on Life Divine, I will take up volume 16. If you can bring your volume 16 SABCL, or there are independent booklets also available, The Problem of Rebirth, you can purchase that, because it's almost about 80 pages, 80, 86 pages. So let us see whatever we can do. And those are short essays, so even by the end of October, I could come to a stop by finishing one essay out of those 86 pages. So I could do that. And when we resume, in the same month of January, I propose to finish this problem of rebirth, because it will help us to understand the next two chapters in a better way. Because he has dealt in a very, very practical manner, and the language is much simpler, but the main issues are the same. Well, today we have little time, and I thought of reading out a few letters from volume 22, You see, these are letters on rebirth, which will be, you know, I'm giving it a kind of a jumping here and there, starting with 445 page number, but I would take up later a continuous reading of these letters also. But today I have selected a couple of letters which are directly dealing with the question we have had here about the human being taking the animal birth. So that was a question that was discussed in the letters too. So I'll read out those for the day. This is page 445. It says, these words do not necessarily refer to the animal birth. There are some words. For example, the word is, these words, adho gachyanti, do not necessarily refer to the animal birth. But it is true that there has been a general belief of that kind, not only in India, but wherever transmigration or metempsychosis was believed in. Shakespeare is referring to Pythagoras's belief in transmigration when he speaks of the passage of bodies of somebody's grandmother into an animal. But the soul, the psychic being, once having reached the human consciousness, cannot go back to the inferior animal consciousness any more than it can go back into a tree or an ephemeral insect. What is true is that some part of the vital energy or the formed instrumental consciousness or nature can and very frequently does so if it is strongly attached to anything in the earth life. This may account for some cases of immediate rebirth with full memory in human forms also. Ordinarily, it is only by yogic development or by clairvoyance that the exact memory of past lives can be brought back. Then the very next letter. It is when the vital gets broken up, some strong movements of it, desires, greeds, may precipitate themselves into animal forms. Example, sexual desire with a part of the vital consciousness under its control into a dog, or some habitual movement of excessive greed may carry part of the vital consciousness into a pig. The animals represent the vital consciousness with mind involved in the vital, so that it is naturally there that such things would gravitate for satisfaction. All human incarnations or births have naturally a psychic being. It is only other types like the vital beings that have not. And that is precisely the reason why they want to possess men and enjoy physical life without being themselves born here. For so they escape the psychic law of evolution and spiritual progress and change. But these formations, vital fragments of a dead person, are different. They are things that do not leave the earth and do not possess, but simply attach themselves to some human rebirth, of course with the psychic in it, which has some affinity and therefore does not object to or resist their inclusion. Now there is a word from the Gita, he is quoting, Asurisu cannot possibly mean animal. Because this is a thing taken from the Gita, so he explains, saying, The Gita uses precise terms, and if it had meant animal, it would have said animal and not asuric. As for the punishment, it is that they go down in their nature to more depths of asurism till they touch bottom, as it were. But that is a natural result of their uncontrolled tendencies, which they freely indulge without any effort to rise out of them, while the cultivation of the higher side of personality, one naturally rises and develops towards Godhead or the Divine. In the Gita, the Divine is regarded as the controller of the whole cosmic action through nature. So the quote-unquote I caste is in harmony with his ideas. The world is a mechanism of nature, but a mechanism regulated by the presence of the Divine. Next letter. As far as I know, the births follow usually one line or the other. This is another argument which is again a popular understanding or misunderstanding, that what is the truth behind rebirth? That means a man always becomes a man and a woman becomes a rebirth of a woman. So how far is the truth he is discussing? And I thought this is again a very popular idea, so let me reach you up in those letters. So he says, as far as I know, the births follow usually one line or the other and do not alternate. That, I think, is the Indian tradition also. Though there are purposeful exceptions like Shikhandis, if there is a change of sex, it is only part of the being that associates itself with the change, not the central being. Next letter. What do you mean by the popular idea? All the instances I have heard of in the popular accounts of rebirth are of man becoming man and woman becoming woman in the next life, except when they become animal. But even then, I think the male becomes a male animal and the female a female animal. There are only stray cases quoted like Shikhandis in the Mahabharata for variations of sex. The theosophist conception is full of raw imagination. One theosophist even going so far as to say that if you are a man in this birth, you are obliged to be a woman in the next, and so on. Next letter. Not sex exactly, but what might be called the masculine and feminine principle is there in the psychic being. It's a difficult question whether sex is altered in rebirth. There are certain lines that reincarnation follows, and so far as my experience goes and general experience goes, one follows usually a single line. But the alteration of sex cannot be declared impossible. There may be some who do alternate. The presence of feminine traits in a male does not necessarily indicate a past feminine birth. They may come in the general play of forces and their formations. There are besides qualities common to both sexes. Also, a fragment of the psychological personality may have been associated with a birth not one's own. One can say of a certain person of the past, that was not myself, but a fragment of my psychological personality was present in him. Rebirth is a complex affair and not so simple in its mechanism as in the popular idea. Now here I am taking a portion of a longish letter, because it's pretty long for the time that we have in hand. A great part of the difficulty of these problems, I mean especially the appearance of inexplicable contradiction, arises from the problem itself being badly put. Take the popular account of reincarnation and karma. It is based on the mere mental assumption that the workings of nature ought to be moral and proceed according to an exact morality of equal justice. a scrupulous, even mathematical law of reward and punishment, or at any rate of results according to a human idea of right correspondences. But nature is non-moral. She uses forces and processes, moral, immoral and amoral, pell-mell, for working out her business. Nature in her outward aspect seems to care for nothing except to get things done, or else to make conditions for an ingenious variety of the play of life. Nature in a deeper aspect as a conscious spiritual power is concerned with the growth by experience, the spiritual development of the souls she has in her charge, and these souls themselves have a say in the matter. So you can see here the ultimate attitude of nature towards the individual souls. By hook or crook to turn them to spirituality, by long or short methods to turn them to spirituality. Because that is the spiritual development is the only concern of nature. So all the problems, so all the difficulties, so all the so-called moral, immoral things that are being done. And it's we the human beings, we classify them this way and that way, but it's saying the only business of nature is to see how fast the soul goes towards the spiritual growth. All these good people lament and wonder that unaccountably they and other good people are visited with such meaningless sufferings and misfortunes. But are they really visited with them by an outside power or by a mechanical law of karma? Is it not possible that the soul itself, not the outward mind, but the spirit within, has accepted and chosen these things as part of its development in order to get through the necessary experience at a rapid rate, to hew through? There's a German word I can't pronounce, it's durchschauen. Even at the risk or the cost of much damage to the outward life and the body. I mean, this is in a letter, but this has a whole philosophy which will be developed in the next chapter. That even at the risk or the cost of much damage to the outward life and the body, the soul, you know, tries to rapidly go towards that its fulfillment of a spiritual life. Because we have many incidents in the ashram itself, you know, which really tell us, and if we really understand life in its true depth, we now get to know that even at the cost of damage of outward life, the soul keeps moving. Now, there was in Madhapandit's accounts, we come across a very interesting account of a lady, an American lady, who had come to the ashram with a very bad skin disease problem. I mean, she had gone to the best doctors in the West and the East, and nowhere and no one could really treat her skin disease. But then when she came here, she does have a meeting with the mother. She sees the mother, has darshan of the mother, and soon after the disease is gone. Then Mother Pandit really asks her what happened. Then the mother seems to have explained that the soul took upon itself this disease only in order to come to me. It wanted to see me. You see, left to herself in her wonderful, systematic, comfortable life, she would have never come to India and to the mother. But the soul wanted to see, to have the visit to come back to the mother. So it had a disease which no doctor could cure. So it took that whatsoever the saving at the cost of the damage of the outward life. So sometimes it takes such rigorous terms only to fulfill that I want to have this meeting with the Divine. So you see, whatever the exactness of the account, it tells us what Sri Aurobindo is telling us here. So oftentimes some of these external problems, our difficulties and, you know, there are plenty of things in everybody's life, they are all for that. To the growing soul, to the spirit within us, May not difficulties, obstacles, attacks be a means of growth, added strength, enlarged experience, training for spiritual victory? The arrangement of things may be that, and not a mere question of the pounds, shillings and pence of a distribution of rewards and retributory misfortunes. It's again a longish letter, but I'll leave it at that, take it next time. But you see, what a tremendous message there. All these experiences, you know, are only the difficulties, the obstacles, the attacks, are all a means of growth, an enlarged experience, training for spiritual victory. I mean, we do know philosophically all this, but if only one can accept this in life, then comes the spiritual victory so much faster. And really, when I read that, I mean, I feel sometimes we are so far removed from all this ideal. You see, I was just reading about Sri Aurobindo. When he was in Baroda, I mean, he hardly ever bothered about his dressing, how he slept, what he ate. I mean, never was there a question of comfort. He says he used to have in at home always that single dhoti, and that never, except to the office where it was obligatory to have a suit, you know, he was in the service of the Maharaja. Otherwise back home he would be in his simple dhoti. But he says even at night, except in the extreme cold weather, he would not put on a shawl or a shirt over his body. He slept, you know, on a simple mattress which hardly would even, somebody wrote a comment, you know, it would be almost a shame to see that a servitor of the Baroda Maharaja is sleeping like that. And food, cold, good, tasty, non-tasty, he never bothered. It was there, okay, he comes to the table, he takes it and goes. But comforts, nothing. So he has seen what this penury is, not a penury, but it is so much of a born yogi. I mean, you know, the detachment of the outer is only, perhaps he got more comfort in the ashram, but rest of his life he used to sleep on a mattress, he used to sleep on a mat on the ground. And you can see the man who has gone through all that, he alone can write this kind of a thing, that, you know, to the growing soul, the difficulties, obstacles, attacks, all these are training for the spiritual victory. So there's so much to learn from these simple letters, that how with every little difficulty we run away from difficulties and move on, trying to find a solution. But now we realize that all this is only the soul seeking for a spiritual victory. Well, I'll read tomorrow again.